Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. This hour of the program, we talk again about Iran. Our guest in a piece in the Washington Times on Tuesday wrote, "Conventional wisdom about Iran has long been that the nation's senior Muslim cleric would have the final say on domestic and foreign policies, no matter who won the June 12 presidential election. But that calculus has been challenged with the explosion of protests in the streets. Iran analysts say Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei could well emerge diminished in stature because of his too quick confirmation of victory of incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, an outcome now discredited by allegations of fraud. This Monday, the National Geographic Channel is going to have a two-hour special on Iran and the West. It's an in-depth look inside today's nuclear-seeking Islamic Republic with footage that goes back to the time of the Shah. And it will feature more than 40 original and rare and candid interviews with key leaders and also with officials. One of the spokespersons in this film and also has been working with the National Geographic is Barbara Slavin, who is our guest this hour, Assistant Managing Editor for World and National Security of the Washington Times, author of a 2007 book on Iran entitled Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She was a senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, responsible for analyzing foreign news. She has lived in Russia, China, Japan, and Egypt, is a regular commentator on U.S. foreign policy on National Public Radio, PBS, and also on C-SPAN. She has visited Iran some seven times, and that's just part of her resume. So she's most qualified for a look not only at what's going on in the streets of Tehran today, but a bit of the history of Iran in the West. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Barbara. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. It's my pleasure. Boy, what timing, huh?
I know. You are so busy these days, I imagine. Not only this special, but everything that's going on. And here you are, an expert on Iran. It is perfect timing for a documentary that looks at the history of this as well.
Yeah, it's terrific. And I have to say, I guess I was an informal consultant on the documentary. A lot of the people that they interviewed were people that I interviewed for my book and events that I wrote about for my book. And I should mention that two of the people in the film are presently in jail in Iran. Ibrahim Yazdi, the former foreign minister during the hostage crisis at the beginning, and Mohsen Aminzadeh, who was a deputy foreign minister, are both in jail now because of their support for Hussein Mousavi, the opposition candidate. So how timely can you get, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's start with a general question here, but this large question, whether or not we have a turning point going on in Iran right now. Is it a turning point, Barbara?
I think it is.
You do.
And that was what I wrote in my paper. No matter what happens, you know, it may take months, years for this to play out. They may, quote-unquote, restore order at some cost, a great cost to human life, but I think Iran has been changed irrevocably by what happened. This is the tipping point. It's a population that's 70% under the age of 30, very connected to the internet, 23 million internet users in a population of 70 million. And what happened was just something that the Iranian public, writ large, could not accept. You know, they came out in record numbers, over 80% voted in this election. It was not because they loved, Mousavi, the opposition candidate, that much, but because they really wanted to express their frustrations with the course that Iran has taken over the last few years. And what happened? Well, according to many people I talked to, the election was stolen out from under them. So, you know, it just catalyzed something. And once you start coming out in the street and protesting and showing that you're willing to make this, you know, this statement and nothing happens to you, well, you keep on doing it.
Mm-hmm. You were asking people to sketch different scenarios of what might happen, and I'm wondering if you agree with this. The first and most likely, an investigation that the Ayatollah ordered on Monday into the election results by the Guardian Council, and I explain what that council is, will grant additional votes to Mousavi, but the incumbent still wins.
Well, you know, that was what people were telling me on Monday. I'm not so sure that they would agree with that now, because this thing is taking on a life of its own. You know, there were 1 million people on the streets on Monday. There were hundreds of thousands on Tuesday, hundreds of thousands on Wednesday. Another rally planned today, another one tomorrow, another one Saturday. And there have also been deaths. And you know from the history of the revolution that you have more demonstrations mourning those who died, right? A month and 40 days, especially 40 days after someone died. So this may not stop. I don't see how they can stop it. And that's why I say that this is a turning point and that the system has been shaken and some accommodation will have to be made. And it may not be enough just to say, well, Mousavi got another million or two votes. I don't think the Iranians are going to be satisfied with that.
What will they be satisfied with?
I think they want a new election.
Ah. And
I think that's what they want.
Yeah, and the possible outcome of that would be Mousavi. Can you see a way that Mousavi would win?
Well, again, it's possible, but I think it, at the very least, they want what they normally have in these elections, you know, which is that the fraud sort of takes place in advance, because you mentioned the Guardian Council. This is a body that vets all the candidates for elected office in Iran. So normally what they do is they disqualify all of those who they don't think are loyal to the regime. You know, that means anybody who doesn't accept the theocracy, the rule of the supreme leader, all of that. And so they commit the fraud in advance. And then the elections are usually relatively free and fair, maybe some shenanigans here or there. But, you know, they openly count the votes in a way that's transparent. That didn't happen this time. So I think that's what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Give us a little bit, and this is what the National Geographic special does so well, give us a little bit of a history here of how it is that we had a country that, about the Islamic Revolution and how that has really governed Iran since 1979.
Well, you have to go back a little farther, really. You should go back to 1953 when the CIA overthrew an elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry, which was then run by the British. The U.S. worried that Mossadegh was too close to the Russians, so they got rid of him. And the Shah was put back on the throne, and he became increasingly autocratic and increasingly unpopular. So the 79 revolution was not just against the Shah, it was against the United States in many ways, against U.S. influence in that country. And the documentary begins with a revolution. It goes into the hostage crisis. You remember when they took 52 Americans hostage, held them for 444 days in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It ironically, Mousavi, our hero now, was a supporter of the hostage taking, like many of the revolutionaries at that time.
And Ahmadinejad wasn't, right?
No, Ahmadinejad, actually, I write about him in my book. He was more anti-Soviet than anti-American at the time, and he suggested that they take over the Russian embassy instead of the American one. Some of the former hostages say that they thought they saw him at the U.S. embassy. It's possible that he wandered through the grounds or had some role, but he was not a leader. And the documentary and also my book, we have interviews with leaders of the hostage taking, who say exactly what they intended. They intended to hold on to the hostages for a couple of days to protest the U.S. Allowing the Shah to come to the United States for medical treatment. He was dying of cancer at that time, and their fear was that it was going to be another 1953. You know, that the U.S. would find some way to somehow restore him to power. So they thought that this thing would take a couple of days, and of course, it became prolonged by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, who used it to eliminate his rivals in the revolution very effectively.
So this idea of the clerics, they're clerics, but they're very politically savvy and sometimes a bit cruel. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, tens of thousands of people were killed during the revolution. It was you know, quite a horrible time in many ways. It was a real revolution, the likes of which we hadn't really seen since the Bolshevik Revolution, I guess. But, of course, a lot of these people have evolved. They're older. Many of them have become politically much more moderate. And one of the things that we have to look for now in this current crisis is what is happening among the clerical hierarchy. You know, Iran has a very complicated political system with a lot of supposed checks and balances, There's an organization called the Assembly of Experts that has 86 clerical members, and they are supposed to supervise the supreme leader and even have the right to get rid of him if he oversteps. Now, I am being told that one of Iran's former presidents, also a cleric, a man named Rafsanjani, is canvassing support in the Assembly of Experts. He heads this body. And, you know, they may, if these demonstrations continue and nothing seems to be able to be done to put them down, perhaps the Assembly of Experts will go to the Supreme Leader and tell him, I'm sorry, you really are going to have to call a new election or the whole system is at stake.
Interesting. And how do you get to be on the Assembly of Experts? Yes.
Yes, as opposed to the Guardian Council, as opposed to the Expediency Council, they have many of these bodies. You're actually elected. There is a slate of clerics that runs, and the people get to vote. And there was an upset, I think it was in 2007, the last election, and Rafsanjani became the head of this body. And he is a sworn opponent of Ahmadinejad. So you have layers within layers, you know, playing itself out, not just on the streets, but in the back rooms.
Well, if I recall correctly, Khamenei came out in support of Ahmadinejad on the election pretty quickly after it happened, didn't he?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I wrote my piece. I thought that was extraordinary poor judgment on his part. He's usually more clever than that, and people are racking their brains to try to figure out why he did it. There are a lot of conspiracy theories. You know, it's Iran. They believe in them. And one of them is that the results were so overwhelmingly against Ahmadinejad that the Supreme Leader freaked out and thought, well, we can't have this. Hmm. And so he moved under pressure from Ahmadinejad and certain supporters of Ahmadinejad to try to nip the whole thing in the bud. But we really don't know. We just don't know what the real vote count was.
Hmm. And is there any way to suspect that it was not a real rigged election and maybe Ahmadinejad won this election?
We just don't know. I talked to someone who has contacts in the rural parts of Iran, and he said that he was speaking to people there, and apparently they came and they took the ballot boxes away after the polls closed. They didn't open them and count the ballots in front of witnesses, which is the normal procedure.
I see.
So people just don't know, and it almost doesn't matter anymore. I mean, we've really moved beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Ahmadinejad won, nobody would believe it now.
Right. So what is it, after living under the Shah in recent memory, people can remember living under the Shah, I'm sure, the Iranian revolution, the Islamic revolution in 79, and now whatever is going on now, what are you hearing as to what it is that people want right now? If Mousavi isn't the guy that everybody's really excited about, what are they excited about?
Well, in a sense, this is a continuation of what they fought for in 79. The revolution was hijacked by Ayatollah Khomeini and the clerics.
Oh.
I think the vast majority of Iranians simply wanted to get rid of the monarchy, and they wanted a more democratic government. They wanted the freedom to express themselves publicly and in newspapers, and all of that was taken away from them by the Islamic regime. Now what we have is the children of those people, you know, as I said, 70% under the age of 30, no mm-hmm. memory of the Shah, who are saying, we want what we didn't get 30 years ago. We want freedom of expression, more personal freedom. We also want a better economy. You know, Iran has managed over the last 30 years because it has enormous oil resources, but the economy has been badly managed, and there have been sanctions of one sort or another against Iran that have prevented it from taking its true place in the international economy and in international affairs. And I think a lot of these young Iranians, they simply want jobs. They want better prospects.
Mm-hmm. And what about we in the West make so much of Ahmadinejad's absolutely ridiculous and damaging comments concerning the Holocaust? He seems to be a fool in so many ways. Are they concerned about that image that Iran is presenting to the world or not?
Yes, I think many people are. You know, he has his constituency. It's been estimated at anywhere from 15 to 20% of the population, mostly lower middle class people. With rural backgrounds, working class, very devout, very religious, you know, no experience of the West and no interest in the West. But many Iranians want better relations with the West. They want better relations with the United States and everything Ahmadinejad has done and said has hurt that.
Mm-hmm. And the relations with the United States is something that the film certainly focuses on. It's been pretty rocky. It's amazing how this country has really influenced presidential elections, hasn't it?
Sure. Jimmy Carter lost because of the hostage crisis. That's why Ronald Reagan won.
Right.
And Carter didn't get a second term. It was a huge humiliation of the United States. A kind of payback, I guess, for our support for the Shah. And then we had Iran-Contra in the mid-80s when the Reagan administration sold weapons to Iran and used the money to support anti-communist guerrillas in Latin America. You remember that?
Sure do.
That almost brought down the Reagan administration. There was talk of impeachment of Ronald Reagan. So we've had quite a history with them. We also have cooperated with them, you know, tacitly, behind the scenes. I write about in my book negotiations that went on from, well, not negotiations, let's call them conversations, after September 11th, from 2001 through May of 2003, the U.S. and Iran cooperated over Afghanistan, and the Iranians also offered cooperation over Iraq. One of the most interesting things in this documentary is that the Iranians basically at one point told the U.S., well, forget about our nuclear program. We'll help you in Iraq if you allow us to have our nuclear program. The Bush administration did not agree. In May of 2003, there was an actual offer, an agenda for comprehensive negotiations between the two countries that the Bush administration never replied to. And I've actually printed the text of this offer in the annex to my book. So there have been times when Iran has cooperated and offered to be of use, and the U.S. has said no, sometimes, of course, for very good reasons. Another thing in the documentary that really struck me, Brent Scowcroft, who was National Security Advisor to the first President Bush, I interviewed him for my book, and he strongly supported U.S.-Iran reconciliation in the early 1990s. And he says in the documentary that he was overruled because Iran, even though it helped get U.S. hostages freed from Lebanon, these were people being held by Iranian allies in Lebanon, Iran was committing other acts of terrorism around the world, and it was too much for the system to bear. And Brent Scowcroft says, I lost the argument, which I think is quite fascinating. He told me that the U.S. and Iran actually had a meeting scheduled in Switzerland in 1990, but at the last minute, the Iranians got cold feet. So, I mean, talk about bitter friends, bosom enemies. This is just such a complicated love-hate relationship that we have had with this country.
Right. And I was also fascinated hearing the advice, whose advice won and whose advice didn't win. Some of the advice was given to not let the Shah in the United States. He roams the world for a while, then he gets sick, and Carter says, you know, on humanitarian grounds, we'll bring him in. But the whole process of how decisions are made and who wins the argument.
Yeah, it's said that Henry Kissinger and the Rockefellers had a lot to do with persuading Jimmy Carter to let the Shah come here, the argument being that he had been our friend in good times and we should not let him down in bad times. But, of course, we see what the result was.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Barbara Slavin is our guest, and we're talking about Iran this hour, what's happening this week, amazing developments this week in Iran, and also a little bit about the history here, because she is one of the people featured in this documentary on National Geographic, which airs this coming Monday, June 22nd, Iran and the West, which goes back to the time of the Shah. And so that's what's going on now. She has been to Iran many times and has written several books on Iran, Iranian regional influence. We have just one line open, so if you don't want to join us, just take the line, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the author of American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. So that's coming up. Hour number two. To your phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Charles from Ingleside, Illinois is first. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. Our relationships with Iran are so twisted and snarled I worked with the Anglo-Irian Oil Company during World War II, at the end of World War II anyway, and the message was that we took the oil concession away from the British because the Iranians were more fearful of the Russians up in the Caspian Sea than they were of the British, so they gave the concession to us, and it kind of runs contrary to what was said this morning, that the Russians were more fearful of the Russians, of the English, and actually, but they were more fearful of the Russians. I understand.
Well, I have to tell you, frankly, I'm not that familiar with that particular period of Iranian history. I know that the British controlled the Anglo-American, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company for many, many years, and then the United States began to come in after the 53 coup, and of course the Shah was in power, and of course he favored the U.S. And not the Russians. The Russians had a rather difficult history with Iran. They actually occupied part of the country after World War II, the Azeri section of the country, which is a Turkic-speaking area. So, I mean, the relationship with the U.S., between the U.S. and the Shah was, of course, very good and very strong. And even before that, Americans started coming as missionaries and teachers and financial advisors, you know, going back even into the late 1800s. And the relationship was good. The U.S. was considered, really, up until 53, a kind of neutral country. We were admired because of our democratic system. You know, as I mentioned, Iran had its first democratic revolt back in 1905. And it was only after 53 that you began to see opposition to the United States build in tandem with opposition to the Shah.
Thanks very much, Charles, for the call. Lynn from Eau Claire is next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. I'm a little interested in not being a conspiracy theorist. Was the rest of the world so interested, involved, when we in 2000 and 2004 had questionable elections?
It's a good question. I've heard this one several times this week. It's really, you know, quite different. I mean, there was a situation, obviously, in 2000 in particular with the hanging chads and the votes in Florida and so on, and a lot of complaints about whether that was fairly done. The recount was stopped by the Supreme Court, and many people in the United States felt that was dreadfully unfair. But it's not like what happened in Iran a week ago. I mean, here you had a situation where the government announced the results, barely after the polls had closed, where they did not have an open and transparent process for counting any of the votes, as far as I can tell, where they published a list of results that seemed implausible to many people. For example, they had Ahmadinejad winning in a city called Tabriz, which is ethnic Azeri. This is a Turkic-speaking area. And the opposition candidate, Mousavi, is himself an Azeri. You know, people just couldn't believe it. And, you know, the Supreme Leader came in and immediately blessed the results. It was all considered just a little bit too much. So we may have our own problems, certainly, with polling machines that don't work and government officials that are biased one way or the other. But I don't think we've ever seen a situation quite like what happened in Iran.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Lynn, for the call. A couple of lines are open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. I guess there's really no way of knowing because we didn't know that this was going to happen this week, but it seems as though it's not the best situation you want to not have things resolved in Iran. We've been worried about their nuclear capabilities and their march toward nuclear weapons. Is it in the best interest of the United States and other countries in the world to kind of let this play out on its own in Iran, or to use some back channel communications, people in the State Department to try and ease the tension, to lessen the violence? What should we be doing?
It's a really difficult question, you know, watching something like this unfold. I mean, I think of the Carter administration back in 78 and 79, you know, watching that unfold and trying to be supportive of the Shah, but at the same time being horrified by the human rights violations that were being committed, the way they were, you know, the Shah's forces were shooting people in the streets, and how hard that was for Jimmy Carter, who was a tremendous advocate of human rights. So it's really, really ticklish. You know, unfortunately, there is a nuclear program going on, and the U.S. doesn't want that to proceed. Funny, you know, the first event that may be coming up quite soon, well, actually, even before then, I think Secretary of State Clinton is supposed to go to a meeting in Italy in preparation for the G8 summit that will talk about Afghanistan, and there's supposed to be representatives from the Iranian Foreign Ministry there.
So, oh, my.
Will she meet with the Iranian Foreign Minister under these circumstances? And then the State Department has given permission for American embassies to invite Iranian diplomats to 4th of July celebrations around the world.
Oh, right.
Will they still come? What should we say to them? You know, so we're going to have some very ticklish moments. So far, the administration has been very sort of careful, expressing support for the Iranians, you know, to have their wishes respected by the government, but saying that the United States will deal with whatever government emerges in Iran. And I think that we're just going to have to watch this day by day.
Really? Can't quite serve hot dogs in Tehran right now, can you?
Well, we don't have an embassy in Tehran, but this would be at embassies around the world where Iran also has diplomats.
Right.
So,
wasn't there
will they come? And,
right.
And what will they talk about?
Well, who would they be?
The ambassador, you know, and other diplomats from the Iranian embassies. I would think they would be rather cautious. If this is still going on in come July 4th, I have a feeling they may not turn up at the American embassy.
Right. And what about Obama? Everything happened so fast, as you know. He gives this major speech in Cairo, and now he's being kind of quiet. Who's advising him on all of this? And considering the fact that he had quite an impact when he gave that speech in Cairo, should he take the world stage here in some way, and could he be effective taking a world stage?
I'm really glad that speech came before all of this happened.
Mm.
So that nobody will say that the two are somehow connected. No, I think it's right for him. He's made plenty of speeches to the Muslim world. He's made plenty of appeals to Iran. Iranians know where he stands. And now is really the time to let the Iranians do this and take their own history into their hands.
Saeed is next from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I am very concerned that the current efforts of the Iranian people will end up in a failure, only because Mousavi himself is an establishment candidate. He was obviously vetted by the Council of Guardians, and he is hardly worthy of the aspirations, of the sacrifices that the Iranian people are making on the streets right now. What is animating the crowds is not their support for Mousavi, but fundamentally it is their desire for freedom, for change in their status. So, can you, Barbara, make a case? Do you have any evidence, or can you make a case for why Mousavi is different than Khatami, who went before him, who was a pseudo reformer? They believe in the rule of the Velayat al-Faqih, and given that, they will derail the current movement rather than guide it. Can you make a case for why Mousavi is different?
That's a really, really good question. You know, and actually we had a profile of Mousavi in our paper yesterday where we really raised that question. So far, he has shown himself to be someone with a lot more guts than President Khatami. I mean, Khatami, when he was elected in 1997, you know, he got the same kind of outpouring of support, young people, women, who really wanted to see change, and they thought he would be the vehicle for it. And, you know, when push came to shove, he backed down. He himself admits. He told me how ashamed he was, really. In 1999, there was a big protest by students at Tehran University. They had closed down a very popular newspaper, and the regime came in and killed students and trashed the campus, and there were big demonstrations that spread all over Tehran. They were mostly of the students. And Khatami, in the end, allowed the crackdown. He said that he was told basically by the Revolutionary Guard, which is a very powerful military force in the country, that the system itself was at stake and that he had to crack down and stop the demonstrations. And so he did. Later, there were some other demonstrations, not on that scale, and he also supported the security services. So he, he chickened out. I mean, even what happened with Madeleine Albright, you know, where she was supposed to sit down with the foreign minister, and then, you know, he couldn't even let his foreign minister go and sit at the UN with Madeleine Albright. I mean, how chicken is that? So I think Mousavi so far has shown that he's not going to back down. He's really pissed. And he has a very tough wife who's a former university chancellor and a bit of an intellectual in her own right, who is perhaps even more popular than he is. And he, you know, he called another massive rally today. He is not giving up. So we will have to see whether he proves to be a false hope. I agree that the people in the streets are not in love with him. He is the vessel through which they are expressing their frustration about their condition. But, you know, the world is full of unlikely heroes. I remember Hatemi told me, he said, you know, I'm not Gorbachev, right? And I compared him in my book. I said he wasn't Gorbachev. He was more like Nikita Khrushchev, who kind of softened the edges of the Soviet Union but didn't really fundamentally change the system. Mm. You know what? Well, maybe Mousavi is Gorbachev. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what the system is for deciding who the candidates will be, Barbara. Who makes that decision?
Well, this is the Guardian Council. This is a body of 12 people. Half of them are clerics who were appointed directly by the Supreme Leader. The other half are lawyers who were named by the head of the judiciary, who is himself named by the Supreme Leader. And they vet all the candidates. So hundreds of people typically will apply to run for president. And this year, out of that list, they allowed four people to run, two reformers, one pragmatic conservative, and the incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So they vet the candidates very thoroughly. And they also are supposed to supervise this election, and now they're supposed to look into voting irregularities and tell people whether the vote was free and fair.
Thanks, Saeed, for your call. Let's go next to Edgar from Stevens Point. Hi, Edgar.
Oh, hello. I wanted to ask the speaker what she thinks of comments that have been made by different American commentators that the victory, the apparently fraudulent victory of Ahmadinejad in this election represents some kind of coup by the Republican Guard, and that the Republican Guard, the
Revolutionary Guard, yeah.
Is basically taking more power at the expense of the Council of Guardians and the clerical establishment.
Republican Guard with Saddam Hussein. It's the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. Again, very good question. Like so many things in Iran, though, it's more complicated than it seems. The Revolutionary Guard is a military force that was set up parallel to the regular army to safeguard the revolution. That's why it's called the Revolutionary Guard. And it is an elite force, but it is itself divided. So there are members of the Guard who have benefited from Ahmadinejad, who is a Guard veteran. He has doled out a lot of very lucrative contracts to members of the Guard, and these people support him absolutely. The Guardian Council, I think, is also on the same side. They're not divided. They're also close to Ahmadinejad and to the Supreme Leader, Khamenei. But there are others who probably oppose them. So it does appear to be a kind of coup by one part of the system against another part of the system. And the question is, will it hold? Will the Guard Corps come out and shoot at Iranians in the streets the way they did during and right after the revolution when they suppressed opposition to the form of government that Iran took after the revolution? I've been talking to people there who say that a lot of the Guard members will not do that, that the armed forces will split. That's one of the reasons why I think we won't see this kind of vicious crackdown, that they're going to try to be somehow more subtle about it, because then they do lose all legitimacy. They become like the Shah and like the Shah's armed forces, which eventually cracked under the stress of the revolution, and that's one of the reasons why the Shah fell.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Edgar?
No. That answered my question very well. Thank you very
much. Thanks. Thanks for the call. Amir from Madison. Hi.
Hello.
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 Yes, go ahead.
Hi. My name is Amir. I am from Iran. I'm Iranian citizen, and I am a U.S. resident. I just came to U.S. a few days ago, and I'm following the issues in Iran. I just wanted to give a comment on the outgoings, you know. Can I?
Yes, sure.
Yes. Well, just to give a big picture, you know, all the things happening now, well, we can just be amused with the details, but to have a big picture, you know, just we can follow the issues that was going on contemporary history in Iran from at least 100 years ago, and how powers had hand in Iran and manipulated the issues in Iran. So, actually, you know, the when Shah went, we just remembered that I was a kid, but, you know, how power toppled him and pulled the rug under him and just even didn't help him after revolution happened, and even the U.S. rejected him. So wasn't this? So to Iranian people now, whole the regime is not wanted. Whatever going on there, you know, they have a clear comment that, you know, they're just under suppression and they don't want this. And they think that they just used in the revolution, and they actually are very sorrowful for what happened. They just want to, you know, their right and their freedom to, again, you know, just correct the mistake they did 30 years ago. And I think that now, after that bad injection happened 30 years ago to Iran, and after this bad fever that, you know, Iran lived in 30 years, it needs a good treat from, again, the powers that actually didn't want a progressive and powerful Iran in Middle East, its role in the 21st century's peace. So I think that now, if really Western countries and all other, let's say, key powers in the world want a real Iran, and its dignity should just give hand in hand and without any, let's say, following any other self-interest or manipulation, help people to voice up and just achieve their real target, that is freedom and democracy and modern Iran.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us for a moment, Amir. I want to ask you a question. Barbara.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what the caller has said. That, you know, as I said, I think the revolution was hijacked 30 years ago. People wanted freedom and democracy, and you know, perhaps they wanted a little bit more religious expression, some, but they certainly didn't want what they got, which was 30 years of harsh religious rule and isolation and war and all the other terrible things that have happened to Iran over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the question of what the outside world can do is a really ticklish one. You know, we've intervened in the past, and it's had a very bad result. I have a lot of confidence in the Iranian people, and I'm sure the caller coming, you know, recently from there does as well. These are really wonderful people. They're very, very intelligent, well-educated, 80% literacy. It's a unique country in that part of the world. Women have to wear Islamic headscarves and whatnot, but they're tremendously feisty. And, you know, one of the interesting things, if you look at this documentary and you see the pictures from the revolution, it's mostly men in the street.
It sure is.
But if you look at the pictures now, there are women everywhere in these demonstrations. They have no fear,
mm-hmm.
and they have taken a really important role in the country despite all of the restrictions, all the efforts to suppress them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the country has changed under the feet of the Ayatollahs. There's nothing they can do about it. It may not be now, it may not be next year, but the change will come. It's really too late to stop it. And so we have to admire the Iranian people, help in whatever way we can, but leave it in their hands.
Mm-hmm. Did you just come from Iran? Were you just in the country recently, Amir?
Yeah, just it is my fifth day in the United States. Though I love it, you know, I love people in U.S., I love the everything in U.S., and I think world and U.S. people should know that Iranian people love them, and even in Middle East, there is no country more, you know, most pro-American than Iranian people, and I think you just know this. But, you know, I'm very cautious about, again, you know, the future. Once, you know, it's a matter of interest also. You know, it's not just a matter of, let's say, dialogue, or it's not a matter of just observation. Well, once, when we see the incidents in 100 years ago, you know, the Mashrutiyat problems, you know, the Reza Khan problems, and, you know, late Shah, and again, after revolution, well, we see that, you know, things haven't just gone healthily and always have been manipulated by powers. And I just can give a comment that, you know, I was reading an article on Radio Farda. It is also, you know, a United-based radio, but usually has news on Iran. And head of Musa said that, you know, nobody like Ahmadinejad can help us. You know, nobody serves our interest better than Ahmadinejad because, you know, we are in love. We can voice up and talk about, you know, aggressive Iran, dangerous Iran, and whatever. And other than, you know, I think, again, everybody knows that, you know, people in Iran, you just go and just do a research at how people believe they're in Iran, about the origin of, clerics and where they come from. They think that, you know, it's still, you know, they are puppet of Royal Britain intelligence system, and they're always feeding them. If you just look at the history, they always have used them opposed to the modernization and progression in the Iran and in Shah.
I need to hold you there, Amir, because we have to pause for a moment. Welcome to the United States, and thank you very much for being with us. And you may want to be in touch with, if you have access to email, our producer, Rhonda Fanning, and because we'll be doing future shows on Iran and would like to hear more of your thoughts. And her email is fanning@wpr.org. We need to pause for just a moment. We'll return. Barbara Slavin is our guest this hour. We're talking about what's going on in Iran right now and about a National Geographic special, Iran in the West, which airs this coming Monday. And we'll take more of your phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Barbara Slavin is our guest, featured in the National Geographic Special, Assistant Managing Editor for World and National Security of the Washington Times, author of several books on Iran, including most recently Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and The Twisted Path to Confrontation. We go next to Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi.
I remember way, way back in the day when I was in Madison, the Iranian students would protest against Savak because Savak was allowed to go through the expatriate community or the student community in the United States and kill them if they protested the Shah. And I know that that would not be possible now, but I am the Savak had quite a national and international operation going. Was any of that co-opted by the current regime? Were all those people executed or exiled, or is there still a Savak in Iran or something like it?
What a good question. You know, I think some of the Savak bully boys did decide to join the revolution, so to speak. The leaders of Savak were certainly executed by the government. This was a vicious force that was set up with the help of the CIA to control popular opinion and get rid of security threats to the Shah during the 1960s and the 1970s, in particular, when they began to crack down very, very heavily on opponents to the Shah. And, yeah, some of the lower-level folks, I'm sure, just became interrogators and jailers for the current regime. You know, that, again, is the betrayal of the revolution, that a revolution that was supposed to bring freedom to all of these people wound up being another repressive government. And it's just a factor. Until Iran actually manages to emerge from this kind of authoritarian history, you will always have a Savak.
Thank you very much for your call. Richard from Fort Atkinson, hi.
Yes, I'd like to offer what I think is a bit more nuanced. I recently saw on CNN just a couple of days ago an interview between Larry King and Ahmadinejad that occurred on September 23rd, 2008. That was shortly before our election. And the statements that Ahmadinejad made were a great deal more nuanced than he has been given credit for here in the United States. For example, with respect to the Holocaust, he did not take what might be his former position, but that he made a distinction between Jews and Zionists, which he is very hostile to. He also pointed out that the United States, because it used Iraq as a proxy in the war in the 80s, and its current involvement in both Iraq and Afghanistan threatens encirclement of Iran, that he takes a very strong defensive, what he says, position against the United States. And I think that keys into our suspicions of their nuclear program, which I believe is probably designed to end up with weapons. But nevertheless, if the United States obeyed its own treaties, the proliferation treaty and the commitments to disarm, and sought instead a nuclear-free Middle East by reducing weapons of that sort with Pakistan, India, and Israel, I think there would be a much different atmosphere in that part of the world.
Barbara.
Well, you've raised a number of points. On Ahmadinejad, yeah, I mean, he, you know, we sometimes portray him as a cartoon character, but he has also reached out to the United States. He was the first Iranian president to send a letter to an American president. He sent a letter to President Bush in the spring of 2006. It was kind of a cockamamie letter, and it was sort of laughed at. Bush never replied. I think he lost a big opportunity there to appeal to the Iranian people. He also, while he was president, allowed his top nuclear negotiator to offer a back-channel dialogue with the U.S. I write about this in my book. A man named Ali Larijani tried to set up a back-channel with Steve Hadley, who was our national security advisor, and the Bush administration refused to do that. Then this guy, Larijani, actually did make some other efforts to negotiate with the U.S. The documentary goes into that in some detail in some rather interesting ways, which I'll leave you to watch the documentary to find out about it. But, you know, there have been efforts, sure. And after Obama was elected, Ahmadinejad congratulated him. So, you know, there's been a kind of competition in Iran. I think many Iranian leaders would like a relationship with the United States, but they want to be able to take credit for it, and they want it on their own terms. You know, and so Ahmadinejad would argue that he's put Iran into a stronger position from which to negotiate with the U.S. because of the nuclear program, because of Iran's growing influence in the region. That said, he has also done things that have been very damaging to his country. His comments about Israel and the Holocaust have won him a lot of support on the Arab street, but they have alienated most of the rest of the world. And the distinction that he makes between Zionists and Jews is one that is often made by people who really, how shall I put it? I mean, I won't say that he's anti-Semitic in a classic sense. You know, Iran has 25,000 Jews in it still, the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside Israel. But his animosity toward Israel is so extreme that it really does verge on classic anti-Semitism. And that is not the view of a lot of Iranians. He is, I think, out of the mainstream when he expresses those views. And when he denies the Holocaust, he's just in lunatic world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. I was interested in the piece that you had this week. Is there something about Iran? Iranian leaders, you write, have said that their nation is far more democratic than monarchies and hereditary democracies in nearby Arab states. Could democracy, as we know it, be more of a possibility in Iran than some of the other nations in the Middle East?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, and that's a point that I make very strongly in my book. 80% literacy. Women are 65% of the university students. 23 million internet users. I mean, you've seen all the Twitters and the Facebooks and everything that they've been using. A society that is largely urban, 70% urban, very cosmopolitan, with a big diaspora of people that come back and forth and see their family. I remember in 2005, I went to Iran via Paris. I had to interview some Iranians in Paris first, and this was a winter when people in Paris were wearing pink. It became a very popular color. It hadn't really hit the U.S. yet, and I went from Paris to Tehran, and all the women were wearing pink. I kid you not. I mean, pink scarves, pink pocketbooks, pink boots. I wrote a piece called The Pink Revolution. Now, where did they get this idea? Well, they saw it on the Internet. They saw it in fashion magazines.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. Barbara, thank you so much for being with us. Barbara Slavin, our guest. The National Geographic special is this coming Monday. It's, I think, at 8 o'clock. It says 9 p.m. Eastern, so I assume it's 8 o'clock. Iran and the West is the title. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios, and we'll come back following the news.